Here we go. Okay, folks, here we are, I hope, on Bloodlines, your folk radio. Skype did an unannounced update, and it just changed all my settings, and I have to figure out a way to get rid of the, what do you call the sound that it makes when you get a message, because I don't want to have that throughout the whole show. I'm going to have to try to figure that out. But in the meantime, we're here to
Weep.
do, yeah, right?
Weep. Weep.
Bling, bling, right? And
Star Trek noises.
I had to reset everything, in the last couple of, well, f last 5 minutes. I was frantically typing in the correct settings. And so here we are. We finally got on. So,
Yep, and my computer this morning I had to reboot everything and get it all started. Evidently, they
yeah.
attacked us overnight.
Could be
With one of their multiple so useful nonsense updates.
yeah, and they don't tell you they're doing the updates,
No.
and everybody, if you, yeah,
Surprise!
I, now something happened also that now I have to double click on someone's name in Skype to bring that
Well, I
person's
will
page up.
say this. I just listened as it came on, and the music is nice and audible. It's nice and loud. It was back to normal volume.
Yeah, very good.
So here
That
we
part
go.
got fixed. I don't know why that went wrong at the last update, right? But if any of you people have had this update unbeknownst, unannounced, you may have to double click on the person's name to bring that person's page up. That's what I had to do. And so we've been having these issues with Skype and various other technical issues, but we're back on live, and by the way, let me go ahead.
I was up at 3 o'clock in the morning. I went downstairs into the whole big lobby where it goes between buildings, and I walked for an hour between 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning. Came back up, got into bed, raised my feet up, and slept with my feet raised all evening. So I feel a lot better. My feet are not twice their size.
Good, good.
So it's not the feet, it's the ankles.
Right.
So we're I'm doing something about that, and I was
Yeah.
been reading all this stuff on the internet. I jacked my chair way up in the air to its tallest position so I can pat my feet and move my ankles as I'm on the computer.
Yeah, very good. Very
And
good.
that helps. They're actually up off the floor. I have to pat them on the floor. Patty, patty.
Okay. All right. So let's get started with Josephus. I'm pretty sure
All
we
right. You
left
want
off.
me to start it out, or you
Yeah.
want to
No,
start
go
it
ahead.
out?
It's section 2 of chapter 5
That's right.
in book 15. Over to you.
Okay. At this time, it was that the fight happened at Actium between Octavius Caesar and Antony in the 7th year of the reign of Herod. And then it was also that there was an earthquake in Judea, such a one as had not happened at any other time, and which earthquake brought a great destruction upon the cattle in that country. And cattle, can mean just livestock in general, okay?
Right, right.
About 10,000 men also perished by the fall of houses, just like happens today. Buildings collapse and crush people and all kinds of stuff, you know. But the army, which lodged in the field, received no damage by this sad incident. Well, they were out on the flat, and there was nothing to fall on them, so they were in good shape.
Mm-hmm.
When the Arabians were informed of this, and when those that hated the Judeans and pleased themselves with aggravating the reports told them of it, they raised their spirits as if their enemy's country was quite overthrown, and the men were utterly destroyed, and thought there now remained nothing that could oppose them. They got fake news, just like we get today.
Yes.
Okay. Accordingly, they took the Judean ambassadors who came to them after all this happened to make peace with them and killed them, and came with great readiness against their army. But the Judeans dared not withstand them and were so cast down by the calamities that they were under that they took no care of their affairs, but gave up themselves to despair. They cucked out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. For they had no hope that they should be upon a level again with them in battles, nor obtain any assistance elsewhere, while their affairs at home were in such great distresses also. When matters were in this condition, the king persuaded the commander by his words and tried to raise their spirits, which were quite sunk. And first he tried to encourage and embolden some of the better sort beforehand, and then ventured to make a speech to the multitude, which he had before avoided to do, lest he should find them uneasy thereat, because of the misfortunes which had happened. So he made an encouraging speech to the multitude in the manner following. And this is section 3, and Eli will take this.
Yeah, a halftime pep talk, right?
Yeah.
Fight, fight, fight. Fight, fight, fight. Now, this section 3 is quite lengthy. Quite lengthy. It takes up an entire page of text.
If you want to stop at a particular paragraph, let me know. I'll follow along with you.
Yeah, I'll do that because it's quite lengthy, and there's about half a page over. You know, I'll pick a good place to stop. Okay, so section 3.
Okay.
This is quotation, so this is from his speech, apparently. You are not unacquainted, my fellow soldiers. He does not address them as fellow Judahites or fellow Israelites, because I bet there's a lot of Judahites in the army who'd say, "Huh? What? You're not a Judahite." Okay. We've been proving this all along here.
Right.
Okay. And it is probable that even those that are most distinguished above others for their courage can hardly keep up their spirits in such circumstances. Oh, this speech is getting off to a rousing start. But since we cannot avoid fighting, and nothing is of such a nature, but it may by ourselves be recovered into a good state, and this by one brave action only well performed, I have proposed to myself both to give you some encouragement and at the same time some information. Okay? Notice he doesn't, like Moses and Joshua, invoke the name of Yahweh or any of the other Israelite priests who always invoke the name of Yahweh before giving a speech to the men, right? Herod doesn't do any such thing. Both which parts of my design will tend to this point, that you may still continue in your own proper fortitude. Wow, is this the way he actually talked? Right? It's like a third person.
It's gobbledygook like modern politicians
use. It's political talk. You don't use political talk to rouse the troops. It's crazy. Mm-hmm. Let's continue. I will then, in the first place, demonstrate to you that this war is a just one on our side, and that on this account it is a war of necessity and occasioned by the injustice of our adversaries. As I recall, it was arranged by the Parthians and to disunite the Arabians and Herod. For if you be once satisfied of this, it will be a real cause of alacrity to you. Alacrity means hurry up. After which I will further demonstrate that the misfortunes we are under are of no great consequence, and that we have, the enemy is not as big and bad as you think, and that we have the greatest reason to hope for victory. I shall begin with the first and appeal to yourselves as witnesses to what I shall say. You are not ignorant, certainly, of the wickedness of the Arabians. We still know about that today. Which is to that degree as to appear incredible to all other men, and to include somewhat that shows the grossest barbarity and ignorance of God. The chief things wherein they have affronted us have arisen from covetousness and envy, and they have attacked us in an insidious manner and on the sudden. And what occasion is there for me to mention many instances of such of their procedure? When they were in danger of losing their own government of themselves and of being slaves to Cleopatra, what others were they that freed them from that fear? Okay, remember that we helped them, and now they've turned against us. You should be angry about that. For it was the friendship I had with Antony, and the kind disposition he was in towards us, that had been the occasion that even these Arabians have not been utterly undone. Okay? And, of course, the Arabians made an agreement under duress. Okay? So he's not being totally honest here.
Oh, surely not.
Yeah. Antony being unwilling to undertake anything which might be suspected by us of unkindness. But when he had a mind to bestow some parts of each of our dominions on Cleopatra, I also managed that matter so that by giving him presents of my own, I might obtain a security to both nations while I undertook myself to answer for the money and gave him 200 talents. So in other words, I gave him money of my own bank account. Yeah, right.
Stole from everybody else.
Yeah, that's correct. And he was a usurper to begin with, okay? And became a surety for those 200 more which were imposed upon the land which was subject to this tribute. And this they have defrauded us of, although it was not reasonable that Judahites or Judeans should pay tribute to any man living or allow part of their land to be taxable. But although, now, if there's anybody who allowed the land to be taxable, it was Herod, right?
As the
puppet of the Romans. Okay? But forget about that, please, troops. But although that was to be, yet ought we not pay tribute for these Arabians, whom we have ourselves preserved. Nor is it fit that they who have professed, and that with great integrity and sense of our kindness, that it is by our means that they keep their principality, should injure us and deprive us of what is our due, and this while we have been still not their enemies, but their friends. Okay? So, you can imagine there's a little bit of murmuring going on among the troops. Man, you know, how long is this speech going to last? And whereas observation of covenants takes place among the bitterest enemies, but among friends is absolutely necessary. Now, didn't Yahweh tell the Israelites not to make covenants with non-Israelites?
Of course.
Okay. So he's the one who's breaking the law and all of this trouble.
Of course, he's not an Israelite. He's an Edomite.
That's right. Right. So he's posturing as if he knows the law. And, you know, I'm sure some Judahites in the troops, among the troops, were saying, huh, yeah, why did he make a league with Rome? Who is this guy who made a league with Rome? This is not observed among these men who think gain to be the best of all things, let it be by any means whatsoever, and that injustice is no harm if they may but get money by it. Is it therefore a question with you whether the unjust are to be punished or not? When God himself hath declared his mind that so it ought to be, and hath commanded that we should hate injuries and injustice, which is not only just but necessary in wars between several nations. For these Arabians have done what both the Greeks and barbarians own to be an instance of the grossest wickedness with regard to our ambassadors, whom they have beheaded. Okay, well, that's what happens when you make leagues with non-Judahites, right? With non-Judahites.
And they still do the same thing today. They cut people's heads off over there. That's they haven't changed.
They haven't changed. That's right.
No.
Yeah, they had a couple of white female tourists in Morocco who they caught out in the backwoods, and they cut their heads off. You know, any white person in Morocco and any of these Muslim lands, you better be careful. Your best bet is not to go there at all. Okay, and I'll just finish this sentence. Whom they have beheaded, while the Greeks declare that such ambassadors are sacred and inviolable, and here there is a footnote. Herod says here that as ambassadors were sacred when they carried messages to others, so did the laws of Judah derive a sacred authority by being delivered from God by angels, or divine ambassadors, or messengers, which is St. Paul's expression about the same laws, Galatians 3:16, Hebrews 2:2. Okay, so...
That's 3:19.
3:19. It is?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, it says 16 here. Very clearly it says 16. Okay. All right, well, back to you. I'll turn it over to you at this point, because that finishes a sentence.
All right.
Okay.
What wickedness, then, can be greater than the slaughter of ambassadors who come to negotiate about doing what is right? And when such have been their actions, how is it possible they can either live securely in common life or be successful in war? In my opinion, this is impossible. But perhaps some will say that what is holy and what is righteous is indeed on our side, but that the Arabians are either more courageous or more numerous than we are. Now, as to this, in the first place, it is not fit for us to say so, for with whom is what is righteous, with them is God himself. Now, where God is, there is both multitude and courage. But to examine our own circumstances a little, we were conquerors in the first battle, and when we fought again, they were not able to oppose us, but ran away and could not endure our attacks or our courage. But when we had conquered them, then came Athenion and made war against us without declaring it. And pray, is this an instance of their manhood, or is it not a second instance of their wickedness and treachery? Why are we therefore of less courage on account of that which ought to inspire us with stronger hopes? And why are we terrified at these who, when they fight upon the level, are continually beaten, and when they seem to be conquerors, they gain it by wickedness? What do the Jews do today?
Same
deal. And if we suppose that anyone should deem them to be men of real courage, will not he be excited by that very consideration to do his utmost against them? For true valor is not shown by fighting against weak persons, but in being able to overcome the most hardy.
Okay, that's not true of Jews today, is it?
No. And they don't do their fighting. They'll shoot little kids.
That's right.
They're throwing rocks at them. But they have us do all the killing.
Yep.
But then, if the distresses we are ourselves under, and the miseries that have come by the earthquake has frightened anyone, let him consider in the first place that this very thing will deceive the Arabians by their supposal that what has befallen us is greater than it really is. Moreover, it is not right that the same thing that emboldens them should discourage us. For these men, you see, do not derive their readiness from any advantageous virtue of their own, but from their hope as to us that we are quite cast down by our misfortunes. But when we boldly march against them, we shall soon pull down their insolent conceit of themselves and shall gain this by attacking them, that they will not be so insolent when we come to the battle. For our distresses are not so great, nor is what has happened an indication of the anger of God against us, as some imagine. For such things are incidental and adversities that come in the usual course of things. And if we allow that this was done by the will of God, we must allow that it is now over by his will also, and that he is satisfied with what has already happened, for he has been willing to afflict us still more thereby. He had not changed his mind so soon. In other words, he's done whooping up on us.
Right.
Well, and as for the war we are engaged in, he has himself demonstrated that he is willing it should go on, and that he knows it to be a just war, for while some of the people in the country have perished, all you who were in arms have suffered nothing. In other words, they were out in the plain and they didn't get buildings
right.
falling on them, but have all been preserved alive, whereby God makes it plain to us that if you had been universally with your children and wives been in the army, it would have come to pass that you would not have undergone anything that would have hurt you. Consider these things, and what is more than all the rest, that you have God at all times for your protector, and prosecute these men with a just bravery, who, in point of friendship, are unjust, in their battles faithless, toward ambassadors impious, and always inferior to you in valor. End quote.
Okay, so demonize the enemy. Right? That's, so the speech wound up pretty well. It was pretty long for a... you know, a pre-battle speech, I would think. But, you know, really, what else? What choice did they have? Right? What choice did they have? Okay. So, paragraph 4. When the Judeans heard this speech, they were much raised in their minds and more disposed to fight than before. So Herod. Yeah, the speech worked. So Herod, when he had offered the sacrifices appointed by the law... Ooh, wait a minute. Footnote here. This piece of religion is worth remarking because it is the only example of this nature that Josephus ever mentions of this Herod, and that it was when he had been in mighty distress, such times of affliction, making men most religious, or to show, give the appearance of being religious. Such times of affliction making men most religious, nor was he disappointed of his hopes here, but immediately gained a most signal victory over the Arabians, while they who just before had been so great victors were now under a strange consternation and hardly able to fight at all. Okay, probably because they were on their own and were not that big a force to begin with. Okay, so Herod the Edomite undertook to offer sacrifices, okay, made haste and took them and led them against the Arabians. and in order to that passed over Jordan and pitched his camp near to that of the enemy. He also thought fit to seize upon a certain castle that lay in the midst of them, as hoping it would be for his advantage, and would the sooner produce a battle, and that if there were occasion for delay, he should by it have his camp fortified. And as the Arabians had the same intentions upon that place, a contest arose about it. At first they were but skirmishes, after which there came more soldiers, and it proved a sort of fight, and some fell on both sides, till those of the Arabian side were beaten and retreated. This was no small encouragement to the Judeans immediately. And when Herod observed that the enemy's army were disposed to anything rather than to come to an engagement, he ventured boldly to attempt the bulwark of itself and to pull it to pieces, and so to get nearer to their camp in order to fight them. For when they were forced out of their trenches, they went out in disorder and had not the least alacrity, that is, they didn't lack speed in leaving, or hope of victory. Yet did they fight hand to hand, because they were no more in number than the Judeans, and because they were in such disposition of war that they were under a necessity of coming on boldly. So they came on to a terrible battle, while not a few fell on each side. However, at length the Arabians fled, and so great a slaughter was made upon their being routed, that they were not only killed by their enemies, but became the authors of their own deaths also, and were trodden down by the multitude and the great current of people in disorder, and were destroyed by their own armor. So 5,000 men lay dead upon the spot.
In other words, the armor was so heavy they fell over and they were trampled by their own people.
Right.
That's what happened.
Very interesting. Well. Yeah. While the rest of the multitude soon ran within the bulwark for safety, but had no firm hope of safety by reason of their want of necessities, and especially of water. The Judeans pursued them, but could not get in with them, but sat round about the bulwark and watched any assistance that would get into them, and prevented any there that had a mind to it from running away. Okay, so they were trapped and had no food or water, so the Judeans could wait them out. All right. Section 5, over to you.
All right, Section 5. When the Arabians were in these circumstances, they sent ambassadors to Herod in the first place to propose terms of accommodation, and after that to offer him, so pressing was their thirst upon them, to undergo whatever he pleased if he would free them from their present distress.
Water.
Yeah, right. Water. Jailer, bring me water.
But he would admit of no ambassadors and no price of redemption, nor of any other moderate terms, whatever, being very desirous to revenge those unjust actions which they had been guilty of toward his nation. So they were necessitated by other motives, and particularly by their thirst, to come out and deliver themselves up to him to be carried away captives. And in 5 days' time, the number of 4,000 were taken prisoners, while all the rest resolved to make a sally upon their enemies, and to fight it out with them, choosing rather, if so it must be, to die therein than to perish gradually and ingloriously. In other words, don't die from thirst, die from a sword.
Yeah. Sounds like the Alamo.
Yep, there we are, 158. Mm-hmm. When they had taken this resolution, they came out of their trenches, but could no way sustain the fight, being too much disabled, both in mind and body, and having not room to exert themselves, and thought it an advantage to be killed in a misery to survive. So at the first onset, there fell about 7,000 of them. After which stroke, they let all the courage they had put on before fall, and stood amazed at Herod's warlike spirit under his own calamities. So for the future, they yielded and made him ruler of their nation. Whereupon he was greatly elevated at so seasonable a success and returned home, taking great authority upon him on account of so bold and glorious an expedition as he had made.
Wow.
And that ends chapter 5.
Ike the Kike, anyone? Hail the conquering Edomite.
Right.
Hail the conquering Edomite. And America has been under Jewish, well, it's under Jewish control, you know, with Wolfson and Delano, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. So, yeah. And so this is what happens when Jews take over our country. They force us to fight battles that are of utter uselessness to us. Okay. All right. Chapter 6, How Herod Slew Hyrcanus. Now, this gets back to the domestic lack of tranquility in Judea under Herod. How Herod slew Hyrcanus and then hasted away to Caesar and obtained the kingdom from him also. Again, this is more proof that Herod was an occupier, a usurper, not a true Judahite king. And how...
He basically sucked up to Caesar.
That's right. And how a little time afterward he entertained Caesar in a most honorable and probably sumptuous manner. Okay. All right. Paragraph 1. Herod's other affairs were now very prosperous, and he was not to be easily assaulted on any side. Yet did there come upon him a danger that would have hazarded his entire dominions after Antony had been beaten at the Battle of Actium by Caesar, that being Augustus Caesar. For at that time both Herod's enemies and friends despaired of his affairs, for it was not probable that he would remain without punishment, who had shown so much friendship to Antony. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. So Octavian, namely Augustus, may just pay him a visit, right? Okay. So it happened that his friends despaired and had no hopes of his escape. But for his enemies, they all outwardly appeared troubled at this case, but were privately very glad of it, as hoping to obtain a change for the better. This shows how little loved Herod was. Okay? As for Herod himself, he saw that there was no one of royal dignity left but Hyrcanus. And therefore he thought it would be for his advantage not to suffer him to be an obstacle in his way any longer, for that in case he himself survived and escaped the danger he was in, he thought it was the safest way to put it out of the power of such a man to make any attempt against him at such junctures of affairs, as was more worthy of the kingdom than himself. Okay? Mm-hmm. Underline that, folks. As was more worthy of the kingdom than himself. And in case...
Because he was of the royal line of Judah.
Correct. That's correct. And in case he should be slain by Caesar, his envy prompted him to desire to slay him that would otherwise be king after him. So, in other words, what have we been telling you about the Jews, all right?
If I can't have it, nobody's going to have it.
That's right.
I'm going to kill everybody that might even be good.
Yeah.
They're self-destructive. That's why they're talking about the Samson option today.
That's right. That's what this
is. If we go down, everybody's going to go down.
Yeah, so if I have to die, let me die without a true heir living, right? So his purpose is to put true Israel in disarray. All right, back to you.
All right. While Herod had these things in his mind, there was a certain occasion afforded him, for Hyrcanus was of so mild a temper, both then and at other times, that he desired not to meddle with public affairs. In other words, he wasn't really interested in messing with any of this. Okay.
Right.
nor to concern himself with innovations, but left all to fortune and contented himself with what that afforded him. But Alexandra, his daughter, was a lover of strife and was exceeding desirous of a change of the government.
Okay, yeah, she didn't like Herod. Her,
right. And spoke to her father not to bear forever Herod's injurious treatment of their family, but to anticipate their future hopes as he safely might. And desired him to write about these matters to Malchus, who was then governor of Arabia, to receive them and to secure them from Herod, for that if they went away and Herod's affairs proved to be as it was likely they would be, by reason of Caesar's hostility to him, they should then be the only persons that could take the government.
That makes sense to me.
And this, both on account of the royal family they were of, and on account of the good disposition of the multitude to them, while she used these persuasions, Hyrcanus put off her suit. That means her...
Yeah, her plea.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But as she showed that she was a woman, and a contentious woman too, and would not stop either night or day, but would always be speaking to him about these matters.
Nag, nag, nag.
And about Herod's treacherous designs, she at last prevailed with him to entrust Dositheus, one of his friends, with a letter wherein his resolution was declared.
A good woman.
And he desired the Arabian governor to send to him some horsemen who should receive him and conduct him to the lake Asphaltitis, which is from the bounds of Jerusalem 300 furlongs. And he did, therefore, trust Dositheus with this letter, because he was a careful attendant on him and on Alexandra, and had no small occasion to bear ill will to Herod, for he was a kinsman of one Joseph, whom he had killed, and a brother of those that were formerly killed at Tyre by Antony.
So he has reason to be angry at a lot of people.
Yet these motives could not induce Dositheus to serve Hyrcanus in this affair. For, preferring the hopes he had from the present king, or ruler, to those he had had from him, he gave Herod a letter.
Oh, man. Stab in the back.
Wow.
Please continue.
So he took his kindness in good part and directed him besides to do what he had already done. That is, go on in serving him by rolling up the epistle and sealing it again and delivering it to Malchus. And then to bring back his letter in answer for it would be much better if he could know Malchus's intentions also.
Boy, talk about
devious.
Well, that's
sneaky.
That's smart. That's really smart, right?
Yeah. And when Dositheus was very ready to serve him in this point also, the Arabian governor returned back for answer that he would receive Hyrcanus and all that should come with him, and even all the Judeans that were of his party, that he would, moreover, send forces sufficient to secure them in their journey, and that he should be in no want of anything he should desire. Now, as soon as Herod had received this letter, he immediately sent for Hyrcanus and questioned him about the league he had made with Malchus. And when he denied it, he showed his letter to the Sanhedrin, and put the man to death immediately.
Wow.
Over to you.
Wow. Wow, wow, wow. Of course,
and this is the doings of his daughter, not him. He didn't write that letter.
Yeah, well, I mean, see, they involved themselves in a league with the Arabians, which is against the law, right, instead of relying on Yahweh. But the affairs of Judea were so in such turmoil, there's no saving. There's no saving Judah anymore. No saving them at all, okay? But it shows you the treachery that Herod is capable of. And, And this is what happens when you have Edomites in your country, folks. I mean,
What do you expect? I mean, you're told all through Scripture what these Edomites are.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, the Sanhedrin were of his choosing. They weren't Judahites.
Yeah, that was his private court.
That's right. Okay. So there may have been a Judahite or two in there, but as we were told earlier, one of the first actions that Herod took when he was appointed by Rome was to slaughter the entire Sanhedrin and replace them with his cronies. Okay? Mm-hmm. So there may have been a traitor Israelite among those, a traitor Judahite. Okay? Mm-hmm. We're not told such details. All right, paragraph 3. And this account we give the reader as it is contained in the commentaries of King Herod. But other historians do not agree with them, for they suppose that Herod did not find, but rather made this an occasion for thus putting him to death, and that by treacherously laying a snare for him. In other words, other commentators say, well, this whole thing was arranged by Herod. Well, certainly, I think that it rings true that Dositheus was asked to deliver this letter, and then he secretly betrayed Alexandra by showing it to Herod. That rings true. I don't know.
His bread was buttered by Herod a lot better than it would have been by the others.
Right. And plus,
and he was looking out for himself.
He was looking out for himself. And whether or not Caesar would invade Judea was questionable. You know. So what's the old saying? A bird in the hand? Right? Mm-hmm. A letter in hand? So right. I could see that the whole story rings true. But rather made this an occasion for thus putting him to death, that by treacherously laying a snare for him. Okay, so in other words, they assume that Herod had plotted this all along by himself. For thus do they write, quote, that Herod, I gotta adjust my vision here, that Herod and he were at once at a treat, maybe a retreat, he and Dositheus, or he and Hyrcanus. He's not very clear here. And that Herod had given
treaty. Okay.
Yeah, it should be treaty. Yeah, okay, at a treaty. And that Herod had given no occasion to suspect that he was displeased with him, but put this question to Hyrcanus. Okay, so we're talking about Hyrcanus. Whether he had received any letters from Malchus. And when he answered that he had received letters, but those of salutation only, and when he asked further whether he had not received any presents from him, and when he had replied that he had received no more than 4 horses to ride on, which Malchus had sent him, they pretended that Herod charged these upon him as the crimes of bribery and treason, and gave orders that he should be led away and slain. So in any case, Herod used whatever excuse he could to murder Hyrcanus. All right, so no matter whose version of this you want to believe, Herod used this as an occasion for murder. And in order to demonstrate that he had been guilty of no offense when he was thus brought to his end, they allege how mild his temper had been. Okay, he was a weak leader, all right? Had he been a courageous leader, this might have turned out differently. And that even in his youth he had never given any demonstration of boldness or rashness, and that the case was the same when he became king. But that he even then committed the management of the greatest part of public affairs to Antipater.
Right.
Whoa. And that he was now above 4 score years old, and knew that Herod's government was in a secure state.
So he was in his 80s, yeah.
Yes,
yeah. So the son of the man he elevated to, you know, his personal advisor, Antipater, murdered him. That's what you get, mm-hmm. folks, when you have a Jewish advisor. He also came over Euphrates and left those who greatly honored him beyond that river, though he were to be entirely under Herod's government. And that it was a most incredible thing that he should enterprise anything by the way of innovation and not at all agreeable to his temper, but that this was a plot of Herod's own contrivance. Okay? All right. Well, either way. Yeah.
He got sucked in.
Yeah, because and even though Hyrcanus, this would be Hyrcanus the first, he had defeated the Edomites in battle, he unfortunately made them part of the nation. Okay, in other words,
he brought them in, had them circumcised, said, "Oh, you can join, the congregation. We'll make you part of Judea."
Yeah, and this was his great crime. Making these Edomites a part of the nation. It's like if the Cowboys and the Indians, and a cowboy said, "Okay, Indians, let's stop fighting. We'll make you all Americans." Right?
Yep. You're all cowboys.
Yeah, you're all cowboys. There you go. All right. Wow. A tragic, but I would say fitting end for Hyrcanus. Back to you.
Well, he brought it on himself. He wimped out. And that's why all these people that lay down and they just let themselves be run over.
Right.
Well, that's what you get.
Yeah. Let me eat grapes.
Right. Just, man.
Right.
Okay.
Wow. What a week leader.
Go ahead.
Section 4. And this was the fate of Hyrcanus, and thus did he end his life after he had endured various and manifold turns of fortune in his lifetime. For he was made high priest of the Judean nation in the beginning of his mother Alexandra's reign, who held the government 9 years. And when, after his mother's death, he took the kingdom himself and held it 3 months, he lost it by the means of his brother Aristobulus. He was then restored by Pompey and received all sorts of honor from him and enjoyed them 40 years. But when he was again deprived by Antigonus and was maimed in his body, he was made a captive by the Parthians, and from there returned home again after some time on account of the hopes that Herod had given him, none of which came to pass according to his expectation. In other words, he was lied to. Surely not.
Yeah.
But he still conflicted with many misfortunes through the whole course of his life. And what was the heaviest calamity of all, as we have related already, came to an end, which was undeserved by him. He was set up by other people.
Okay. Right.
His character appeared to be that of a man of a mild and moderate disposition, and suffered the administration of affairs to be generally done by others under him.
Oh.
He was adverse to much meddling with the public, nor had shrewdness enough to govern a kingdom. And both Antipater and Herod came to their greatness by reason of his mildness, and at last he met with such an end from them as was not agreeable either to justice or piety.
So in other words, he didn't have enough toxic masculinity to be a fit ruler, right?
he was a wuss.
A wuss, right? There you go. All right. That's what happens, feminists, when you have a weak leader. Okay, you have a weak leader.
Yeah, you want to breed out all the men in the rape gang, and when the rape gangs come for you, you won't have anybody to protect you.
There you go.
Oh well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
they can kill you and eat you like they do over in Africa.
Right.
At that restaurant over there.
Yep. Exactly. All right. Paragraph 5. Now Herod, as soon as he had put Hyrcanus out of the way, made haste to Caesar. Okay. All right, now you know he's going to grovel. You see some groveling upcoming here, Pastor Steve? And because he could not have any hopes of kindness from him on account of the friendship he had with Antony, he had a suspicion of Alexandra, lest she should take this opportunity to bring the multitude to a revolt. Guess who's going to die now? And introduce a sedition into the affairs of the kingdom, that is, against him. So he committed the care of everything to his brother Pheroras, and placed his mother Cypris and his sister Salome, both Edomites, folks, and the whole family at Masada, and gave a charge that if he should hear any sad news about him, he should take care of the government. But as to Mariamne, his wife, because of the misunderstanding between her and her sister, his sister, and his sister's mother, which made it impossible for them to live together, he placed her at Alexandrium with Alexandra, her mother, and left his treasurer, Joseph, and Sohemus of Etruria, to take care of that fortress. These two, in other words, you got to separate the women. Otherwise, they'd be fighting amongst themselves, and some bad things might happen. These two had been very faithful to him from the beginning, and were now left as a guard to the women. They also had it in charge that if they should hear any mischief had befallen him, they should kill them both, and as far as they were able, to preserve the kingdom for his sons and for his brother Pheroras. Okay, so the Judahite women would have been killed.
That's correct.
If anything had happened to Herod, back to you.
Yep, and the Edomite women were in a separate spot, so they were all right.
Yep.
Masada. Take care of his own.
The famous Masada.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Section 6. When he had given them this charge, he hurried to Rhodes to meet Caesar. And when he had sailed to that city, he took off his diadem, but remitted nothing else of his usual dignity. In other words, he didn't show any royalty with a royal diadem because he didn't want to offend the Caesar.
Right. He was humbling himself before Caesar. Yes.
Yep. Exactly. Okay. And when, upon his meeting him, he desired that he would let him speak to him, he therein exhibited a much more noble specimen of a great soul.
There's the acting ability of the Edomites. It's incredible.
Absolutely. For he did not betake himself to supplications, as men usually do upon such occasions, nor offered him any petition, as if he were an offender, but after a fearless manner gave an account of what he had done. For he spoke thus to Caesar, that he had had the greatest friendship for Antony, and did everything he could that he might attain the government, that he was not indeed in the army with him, because the Arabians had diverted him, but that he had sent him both money and grain, which was but too little in comparison of what he ought to have done for him. For if a man owns himself to be another's friend, as knows him to be a benefactor, he is obliged to hazard everything, to use every faculty of his soul, every member of his body, and all the wealth he has for him, in which I confess I have been too deficient. However, I am conscious to myself that so far I have done right, that I have not deserted him upon his defeat at Actium, nor upon the evident change of his fortune have I transferred my hopes from him to another, but have preserved myself, though not as a valuable fellow soldier, yet certainly as a faithful counselor to Antony. When I demonstrated to him that the only way he had to save himself and not to lose all his authority was to slay Cleopatra. For when she was once dead, there would be room for him to retain his authority and rather to bring you to make a composition with him than to continue at hostility any longer.
Okay.
Yeah, let me just interject here. These statements are basically true.
Yeah, okay.
He hated Cleopatra.
Yeah, yeah.
But the reason he hated Cleopatra was because she was trying to interfere with his government. Okay, he's not revealing that, right? He's just saying, this is the advice I gave Antony, and he refused to listen to me, that person, right? Back to you.
Yeah, right. Uh-huh. None of this advice did he attend to, but pervert his own rash resolution before him, which have happened unprofitably for him, but profitably for you. Now, therefore, in case you determine about me and my readiness in serving Antony, according to your anger at him, I own there is no room for me to deny what I have done, nor will I be ashamed to own, and that publicly too, that I had a great kindness for him. But if you will put him out of the case, and only examine how I behave myself to my benefactors in general, and what sort of friend I am, you will find by experience that we shall do and be the same to yourself. For it is but changing the names and the firmness of friendship that we shall bear to you will not be disapproved by you. This is major sucking up.
Yeah, right, exactly. I admit that I was the friend of your enemy, but in so doing, I just... displayed my, you know, my faithfulness to my friend.
This is how I am. I'm a good buddy.
What's right?
Yeah. And I'll be your good buddy too, Caesar.
Okay.
You know, don't kill me. Let me be your friend so I can undermine your authority.
Yeah.
You schmuck.
Right.
Yes. Okay, I understand there's cracking and popping from this headset. I'm just going to have to get another headset.
Sound good.
Yeah, but there is a bit of crackling and popping coming from the headset itself. And Brother Hebert noticed it, okay? So
it's your mic might be a little hot.
Yeah.
It's your microphone, not the headset.
Right. Okay. All right, paragraph 7. By this speech, and by his behavior, which showed Caesar the frankness of his mind, he greatly gained upon him who was himself of a generous and magnificent temper, insomuch that those very actions, which were the foundation of the accusation against him, procured him Caesar's goodwill. Okay?
And sucker!
Right. But I think the same... I think not that Hyrcanus... Herod would have known the circumstances under which Octavius became king, that he was also, you know, Antony was his friend at one time, right? So he can understand. He can understand Herod's situation. So whether by good fortune or by, you know, the gullibility of Caesar, of Octavian here, he was spared. Okay? That's that. Accordingly.
Okay, wait a minute. I'm reading the comments in the chat room. Have you got an adjustment that you can reach easily for your mic?
I'm using a headset, but I just noticed there's crackling coming from your end. It's kind of my end.
Am I crackling?
Yeah, it's kind of like cellophone or a cellophone.
Oh,
cellophane.
I was moving my headset around. That was my fault. I had to scratch my ear.
Yeah. Don't do that.
Don't do that.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So anyway, we'll both check our settings here. And, you know, I was intending on getting a new headset anyway. All right, so let's continue.
Let me mute my mic so I don't make any noise at all.
Okay, while I read this. Okay.
And then when it's my turn, I'll turn it back on.
Right, okay, and I'm just checking. We still got a little less than half an hour. So where did I leave off? Okay, accordingly, Caesar restored him his diadem again, and encouraged him to exhibit himself as a great friend to himself as he had been to Antony, and then had him in great esteem. Moreover, he added this, that Quintus Didius had written to him that Herod had very readily assisted him in the affair of the gladiators. So when he had obtained such a kind reception, and had, beyond all his hopes, procured his crown to be more entirely and firmly settled upon him than ever, by Caesar's donation, as well as by that decree of the Romans, which Caesar took care to procure for his greater security, he conducted Caesar on his way to Egypt, and made him presents, even beyond his ability, to both him and his friends, and in general behaved himself with great magnanimity. He also desired that Caesar would not put to death one Alexander, who had been a companion of Antony, but Caesar had sworn to put him to death, and so he could not obtain that his petition. And this is all a part of the struggle between Herod and Alexander. That, you know, what's his name? Herod had hedged his bets and temporarily took care of one of Octavian's, you know, military leaders. I don't know if he was a general or not. Okay. But, you know, Herod was very shrewd. And and obviously there's no way he could fight against Caesar's minions. So he helped this guy out. And so Caesar remembered this now. So he could not obtain that his petition. And now he returned to Judea again with greater honor and assurance than ever, and affrighted those that had expectations to the contrary, as still acquiring from his very dangers greater splendor than before. Man, this guy was lucky. Two demerits each, right? This guy was lucky, 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 all right, as Jews are today. You know, they rule over us by intrigue. And sometimes you get a little luck, too. So he prepared for the reception of Caesar as he was going out of Syria to invade Egypt. And when he came, he entertained him at Ptolemy with all royal magnificence. He also bestowed presents on the army and brought them provisions in abundance. That's, of course, belonging to the true Judahites. He also proved to be one of Caesar's most cordial friends and put the army in array and wrote, just like a typical politician, he goes with the wind, and rode along with Caesar and 150 men, well appointed in all respects, after a rich and sumptuous manner, for the better reception of him and his friends. He also provided them with what they should want as they passed over the dry desert, insomuch that they lacked neither wine nor water, which last the soldiers stood in the greatest need of. And besides, he presented Caesar with 800 talents and procured to himself the goodwill of them all, because he was assisting to them in a much greater and more splendid degree than the kingdom he had obtained could afford, by which he more and more demonstrated to Caesar the firmness of his friendship, in other words, deficit spending, and his readiness to assist him. And what was of the greatest advantage to him was this, that his liberality came at a seasonable time also. And when they returned again out of Egypt, his assistances were no way inferior to the good offices he had formerly done them. So, in other words, to secure his friendship with Caesar, he went to every possible effort to make Caesar a friend. Over to you.
Yeah, you're clacking and clicking. I guess if you move...
No,
yeah,
it's in the headset. It's in the headset. I have to get a new one. Okay.
At least this one doesn't echo.
I thought that you had got that new microphone.
Yeah, I did, but I haven't been able to completely set it up. So I'm going to have to use it.
Because you sounded good the other day.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah. Okay.
So at least I know it's not me, it's you.
Right, okay.
It's all your fault, Mike.
Right, right.
Okay. Man. Well, made in Korea.
Right.
Yeah, my mic was off, and it is Eli's mic.
Yeah, it's my headset. Yeah, okay.
Clackety, clickety, clunk. Mm-hmm. Okay, now that ends chapter 6. We're in chapter 7, and we have about 20 minutes here. How Herod killed Sohemus and Mariamne, and afterward Alexandra and Costobarus and his most intimate friends, and at last the sons of Babas also. He just killed everybody.
Yeah.
Man, what a lovely person.
Well, he didn't trust anybody.
Well, you know, he shouldn't. Fake news, everybody hates you.
Right.
I love that little song.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, yeah. So he
did you tell the truth?
So he was constantly afraid that somebody might turn against him. What's the term?
Paranoid.
Yeah.
Well, you got one noid, that's enough. Not enough. You got to get another one so you have a paranoid, right?
Yeah, there you go. Right.
Noids, yes.
He had two noids.
never mind. Let me get a drink of coffee. Yeah. I'm laughing.
But man, what an account of Herod's deeds. Where talk about being in trouble one moment and being let off the hook the next. How many times does this happen?
You never get taught this. Anywhere, I mean, just this book of Josephus is such a wealth of facts.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this guy he's documenting all the little twists and turns, and this is like a biblical soap opera.
It is total soap opera,
and just you know, boy.
The queen of anyway. Queen of Hearts, off with his head. Brother Aver says they're hymenoids. Obamanoids. That's what we got today. Hymenoids and Obamanoids. Back to you.
Obamanoids. section 1 of chapter 7. However, when he came into his kingdom again, he found his house all in disorder and his wife, Mariamne, and her mother, Alexandra, very uneasy. For as they supposed, what was easy to be supposed, that they were not put into that fortress, Alexandrium, for the security of their persons, but as into a garrison for their imprisonment, and that they had no power over anything, either of others or of their own affairs, they were very uneasy. And Mariamne, supposing that the king's love to her was but hypocritical, and rather pretended as advantageous to himself than real, she looked upon it as fallacious. She also was grieved that he would not allow her any hopes of surviving him if he should come to any harm himself. because he had given that order to kill her.
That's right.
She also recollected what commands he had formerly given to Joseph, insomuch that she tried to please her keepers, and especially Sohemus, as well apprised how all was in his power. And at the first, Sohemus was faithful to Herod and neglected none of the things he had given him in charge. But when the women, by kind words and liberal presents, had gained his affections over to them, he was by degrees overcome, and at length revealed to them all the king's injunctions, and this on that account mainly, that he did not so much as hope he would come back with the same authority he had before.
Okay.
In other words, thought he was going to get demoted, so he was talking out of school, in other words.
Right.
Okay. Rather, he thought that he should both escape any danger from him, Herod, and supposed that he did hereby much gratify the women who were likely not to be overlooked in the settling of the government, and that they would be able to make him abundant recompense, since they must either reign themselves or be very near to him that should reign. He was trying to set up his feather his little nest.
That's right.
He had a further ground of hope also, as though Herod should have all the success he could wish for and should return again, he could not contradict his wife in what she desired, for he knew that the king's fondness for his wife was inexpressible. These were the motives that drew Sohemus to reveal what injunctions had been given him. So Mariamne was greatly displeased to hear that there was no end of the danger she was under from Herod, and was greatly uneasy at it, and wished that he might obtain no favor from Caesar, and esteemed it almost an insupportable task to live with him any longer. This she afterward openly declared without concealing her resentments.
Okay.
So she talked herself into the
right. So she began openly declaring that she hates Herod and despises him and his actions, right? So, well, she figured she was going to die anyway, so she might as well open up. Yep, she was right. Okay. All right. Section 2. And now Herod sailed home with joy at the unexpected good success he had had, and went, first of all, as was proper, to his wife, and told her, and her only, the good news, as preferring her before the rest, on account of his fondness for her, and the intimacy there had been between them, and saluted her. But it so happened that as he told her of the good success he had had, she was so far from rejoicing at it, that she rather was sorry for it, nor was she able to conceal her resentments, but depending on her dignity and the nobility of her birth, in return for his salutations, she gave him a groan. Huh. Fie on you. And declared evidently that she rather grieved than rejoiced at his success, and this till Herod was disturbed at her, as affording him not only remarks of her suspicion, but evident signs of her dissatisfaction. This much troubled him, to see that this surprising hatred of his wife to him was not concealed but open, and he took this so ill, and yet was so unable to bear it on account of the fondness he had for her. So he was smitten by Mariamne, who was in fact a Judahite, namely a white woman, obviously a very beautiful white woman, that he actually did love her. But you know, he would have put her out of the way anyway.
Whatever. Shik's a goddess.
Shik's a goddess. There you go. Very good. Okay. So, but sometimes was angry at her and sometimes reconciled himself to her. A love-hate relationship. But by always changing one passion for another, he was still in a great uncertainty, and thus was entangled between hatred and love. Man, she must have been a hot babe. to elicit such responses from Herod, and was frequently disposed to inflict punishment on her for her insolence towards him. How dare you, woman? But being deeply in love with her in his soul, he was not able to get quit of this woman. In short, as he would gladly have her punished, so was he afraid lest, ere he were aware, he should, by putting her to death, bring a heavier punishment upon himself at the same time. Okay? So, in other words, to publicly execute her would have been a very difficult thing to do. The people would have said, what the hell is going on? Right? Why is
she was of the royal house, and the people knew that.
Amen. Amen, amen, or amen, I say to you. All right, I think we have enough time left to do section 3.
Yeah.
Okay.
Section 3. When Herod's sister and mother perceived that he was in this temper with regard to Mariamne, they thought they had now got an excellent opportunity to exercise their hatred against her and provoked Herod to wrath by telling him such long stories and slanders about her as might at once excite his hatred and jealousy. So these two Edomite women were bad-mouthing the Judahite woman.
Yeah, that's right. Do you think maybe Shakespeare read this stuff and used it as the basis for his stories?
Man, I'll tell you what. Now, though he willingly enough heard their words, yet he did not have courage enough to do anything to her, as if he believed them, but still he became worse and worse disposed to her, and these ill passions were more and more inflamed on both sides. While she did not hide her disposition toward him, and he turned his love to her into wrath against her. In other words, she cut him off and wouldn't give him
anything. Right, right. Yeah, well, it's really obvious that when a woman, let's say your wife, has determined that you're a foul creature and doesn't have any more to do with you, she cannot restrain herself from telling you, right?
Yep, you're hit.
Yeah, it was a mistake in this case, but she was resolved to die. Back to you.
Yep. But when he was just going to put this matter past all remedy, he heard the news that Caesar was the victor in the war and that Antony and Cleopatra were both dead and that he had conquered Egypt. Whereupon he hurried to go meet Caesar and left the affairs of his family in their present state. However, Mariamne recommended Sohemus to him as he was setting out on his journey and professed that she owed him thanks for the care he had taken of her and asked of the king for him a place in the government. They keep calling him a king here.
Right.
He's not a king. He's a tetrarch.
Right. Yes.
Upon which an honorable employment was bestowed upon him accordingly. Now, when Herod was coming to Egypt, he was introduced to Caesar with great freedom as already a friend of his and received very great favors from him. For he made him a present of those 400 Galatians who had been Cleopatra's guard.
Wow.
And restored that country to him again, which by her means had been taken away from him. He also added to his kingdom Gadara, Hippos, and Samaria, and beside those the maritime cities Gaza and Anthedon and Joppa and Strato's Tower.
Yeah, so
and
Cleopatra.
That ends Section 3.
Yeah, so Cleopatra actually had Galatian guards. Very interesting. Judahites.
Yeah, that's, well, yeah, they were what's now called Spain. It's Galicia.
Right. Yeah, or southern France.
Yeah.
And, and then there's also
the Gauls.
Exactly, the Gauls. Right, right. And they would have been allies of the Greeks anyway, okay? Right. So here we see that the conflicted nature of Judahite loyalties, okay? But it all depends
They were all out for themselves. This
right.
faction was for this guy, and that faction was for another guy. It was the fall of Judea. It was going down. This is by Yahweh's design. You know?
Yeah, yeah. You're like the Swiss guard at the Vatican, right?
Right. I'm looking at section 4, and it's a big, long one, Eli, and we're almost...
No, we won't have time to do this, yeah.
Out of time. Yeah. So we'll stop at section 4.
Okay. Now, looking ahead, and this book has some great illustrations. On page 329, there's an illustration of the amphitheater of Herod. Herod, it must be understood, folks, Herod was a pagan. He was a total pagan. He erected all kinds of statues to pagan gods. He built a Roman city called Caesarea in honor of the Caesars, right? There was no way, shape, or form that Herod was a Judahite / Israelite. Absolutely no possibility, okay? Yet, the Judeo-Christian historians and theologians make no mention of this paganism. And this forces people who aren't aware of what's really going on to assume that he was a Judahite in the line of, what, David?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. He was an Edomite, the eternal enemy of our people Israel. And this must be clearly understood. The churches have been remiss in not informing us of the reality of the situation. As someone earlier pointed out in the chat room, it was this same Herod who tried to kill baby Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? That's what a insidious creature this Herod really was. Okay? And but this whole book, this whole section by Josephus, the great detail he gives us about the life of Herod proves beyond any shadow of doubt that he was, as you said, it's a scaredy cat, but yet when the opportunity arose, he could either grovel or pretend to be gracious, whatever he deemed necessary to for his survival. All right, so both devious and cunning, and you know, when he needed to be, he could act, even though he wanted to commit suicide because of fear. And he killed his entire family because he was afraid they were out to get him, to dethrone him. What a personality. Unbelievable. But
well, it shows...
Paranoid.
Yeah.
That the Edomites are...
Paranoid.
They're so crazy, man.
They are, right. Yeah, yeah. Manic depressive. Manic depressive. As a species, as a group, as a bloodline, manic depressive. That's why Jews have the highest incidence of insanity and genetic diseases, because their bloodline is totally contaminated. What do you expect? You expect a stable personality?
They have no life force themselves, so they breed and race mix to get some life force from some of the other races that they mix with, which creates more genetic instability.
That's right.
So.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, man. And in the book of Deuteronomy, we're told that if we obey Torah, we will have no diseases, or the diseases we have will be mild. So now look at the Jews. With all the diseases they have, are they obeying Torah?
They have nothing to do with the Torah. They're Talmudists.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, yeah. Brother Abair says, Herod's son Agrippa I supposedly started Freemasonry in 43 AD to combat Christianity. That's possible. That's certainly possible.
Could be.
Although the Freemasons themselves claim it was it was founded by Solomon. Solomon in his degeneracy.
He had those rings and stuff that he summoned demons and had control over demons.
Right.
And yeah, he got Solomon was a bad actor in his last days.
Yeah, he was. He was.
He was really bad.
So, yeah, I don't think he is going to be in the kingdom, folks. I really don't.
No. Well, we got less than one minute. It's right. Ticking down. So
okay, folks.
I'm glad that I could do the whole show today.
Yeah, me too.
I got plenty of rest and had my feet up. And I have my chair way up in the air, and I'm bouncing around on my feet. And
Maybe you should do handstands and headstands too, right? Okay, good job.
I can't stand on my head. My legs aren't that long.
Okay. All right, folks. Thanks for listening. All right, pray for Pastor Steve to overcome this current ailment. Praise Yahweh. Pass the ammunition. Thank you all for listening. Goodbye.
May Yahweh bless and keep you, brothers and sisters.